This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, the strange case of Professor Lupin, the subversive power of speculative fiction. So we're going with something a little bit different this week, and that's looking at themes in speculative fiction which challenge commonly held preconceptions or look at areas which sometimes people find a bit less savoury. And I think one of the great things about, say, fantasy, for example, is that it takes things, puts them in another context, and allows you to examine them without a lot of the emotiveness around it.
Yeah. And that can be both negative and positive.
Yeah.
Depending what the topic is, depending how it's portrayed, and also depending on the kind of research that the author has done around what they're trying to and how, you know, that they handle it.
Yes, absolutely. And now the thing with themes that are considered subversive is sometimes they creep in without the author being consciously aware of them, just because that's how the author perceives the world. They're so almost, not entrenched isn't the right word, but they're so surrounded by that thought,
yeah,
and feeling, that theme in their own lives, in how they perceive the world, that it's naturally going to come out in their writing. Octavia Butler, for instance, was actually quite surprised when she was asked in an interview. The interviewer sort of took it for granted that she was really trying to advance a POC type agenda. And she said, well, no, I'm not actually. It's just that's how I see the world. She's written,
yeah,
brilliant science fiction, and almost all of her characters are POC characters, because why wouldn't they be? You know, her standpoint is, you know, I'm a POC author. I'm writing characters in my wheelhouse, as it were. And she wouldn't say that it was actually a theme she was exploring, but, you know, she explored it by default because it had crept in.
Yeah. And it is something, yeah, again, to consider, which is that we are, limited is the wrong word, but we are affected by what we know.
Yes.
And things can creep in that the writers themselves are unconscious of. And it happens quite a lot. And it might not be that they're trying to sort of further an agenda. It might just be that their own experiences have an effect on how they choose to handle certain things. So they might not even be doing it on purpose, but it can end up being about something that they didn't even intend it to be.
Yeah. And I think sometimes you can also be an author and have something in the back of your mind which isn't really relevant to the plot, so you don't explore it. And then unfortunately, because it's in there enough for people to see it's there, you can catch flack for it later because you didn't explore it. And it was a big, you know, for some groups of people, that was actually a really big issue. That was something they wanted to see more of. And I'm thinking here of J.K. Rowling saying later on after the seventh book of Harry Potter that Dumbledore was gay. She'd always thought of him as gay. It wasn't a big deal for her because it wasn't really a major part of the plot, other than the fact that Dumbledore clearly had a romantic friendship with Grindelwald.
Yeah.
But for people who wanted to see themselves represented in those books, that felt like a real slap in the face.
Yeah. Again, this is a case of... It wasn't a big deal for her because she isn't part of that community. And she wasn't trying to represent that community. She was just sort of letting her, you know, it was about her own experience and stuff like that. And she sort of looked out and she looked out into the world and saw people of all different kinds. And she wasn't thinking, how can I represent them? She was just thinking, oh, this character is also gay. But that's not what the story is about. And so she wasn't consciously doing that. And again, because her readership is so wide, and she's now been placed on quite a pedestal, people expect a lot more from her, you know, whether that's fair or not. You know, if you've been given a certain power, are you more obligated, or not? There was a big backlash when she turned around. Some people were thrilled at the idea that Dumbledore was gay, and some people just went, so why didn't you actually represent that in any way? Why are we only being told that afterwards, where it's almost inconsequential?
Yeah, and you can see both perspectives here. And as an author, you're not going to think about everything every single time. Really, she was a victim of her own success there, because as you say, her readership was so wide that she could hardly avoid offending someone.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, again, it comes down to that bit, which is that we are limited by what we know. And we do fall into traps. And I think that no matter what you write, someone out there is not going to like it.
Yeah.
And it's about sort of drawing a line, which is that eventually you have to produce something. And you can't be conscious of everything and everybody, because the world is so incredibly diverse. In the world, there are so many different sort of experiences. And the thing is that two people who have the same disability or who have the same sexuality might read a text in two completely different ways. So there is going to be someone who doesn't like it, and there is going to be someone who feels totally represented.
Yeah.
Now, I think that brings us quite neatly to one thing in Harry Potter, which is very relevant to what we're talking about today and is obviously in our title, which is the whole Lupin werewolf thing.
Yeah.
Now, J.K. Rowling came out and basically said that that was a metaphor, Lupin being a werewolf was a metaphor for AIDS. Which some people said, well, yeah, obviously, we kind of already knew that. And some people were very upset about, and some people liked and some people didn't. Now, what were your thoughts around that, Jules?
I wouldn't have said I registered it consciously at the time, but then I wasn't surprised when I did hear that. So it was a case of, and then I thought, well, actually, that's a pretty good thing in a way to do, to have. It's neither represented as good or bad, but you see how somebody who has something that makes them an outcast, which is clearly none of their fault, because obviously Lupin receives the bite as a child. He can't help the fact that he's a werewolf. That's not his fault at all. And I think as a metaphor, it works very well. Whether people who do live with HIV feel that others them, I don't know. And I haven't read an awful lot about it since.
I guess I feel two ways about it. And when I was growing up, it was very similar, which is when someone said, it's about AIDS. I thought, well, of course it is. But it's not that I thought about it, but that just made kind of sense. But sort of, I did read up a little bit about it, and I can understand why some people were upset. And it wasn't necessarily about the way that it had been represented, but perhaps some of the way that it had been handled. Now, Lupin basically really saw himself as half a man because of what he had. And it did address something quite important, which is the horrific stigma that went with having AIDS and then people sort of getting really worried about being anywhere near anyone who suffered from HIV or, who had it. And this kind of this gross misunderstanding of what it was and how it was transmitted and how it affected people and this treatment of people who suffered from it. I think that was good that was represented. And Lupin basically really thinks of himself as half a man and he worries about Tonks and having a child with Tonks and what it will mean. And I think that it's very possible that there were people, especially, in J.K. Rowling's experience, there were people who, after all of the horrific stigma that they'd been through and the way that they were treated, possibly did start to feel that way, genuinely started to feel, because they were being treated as second-class citizens, that's what they were, and that they were lesser, and that they were a bit doomed and stuff like that. I think that is incredibly likely. Now, where I can understand, and where a lot of people, I think, have a problem with it, was that was all we really got from it. And that pretty much all of the other werewolves were just bad. And Lupin was just a sad story, okay? And it wasn't ever really addressed in any other kind of way. And that the only representation we really got from it was this kind of just the despair and sadness, and then he died.
Yeah, I can kind of see that, but I also got from it the fact that he still managed to live quite a positive life. He had positive effect on other people, so his life did have value even if he didn't see it himself in the same way. But also that the other werewolves weren't so much bad, but that they were easy targets to sway to the opposite side because they'd been othered and marginalised and pushed aside by the wizarding community.
Yeah, but that wasn't really shown,
I think. It was. I think it was. That's what I
don't think.
It.
I don't think it was. I think it's something that you could get out of it. But I don't think it was really, really shown. And I don't think the whole thing was really addressed. And I'm not really sure how much research J.K. Rowling did into it, or whether she spoke to anyone about it. And again, there's this element of the fact that you're not going to please everyone. And there's this element of representation, which is that because some people and some minorities and some disabilities are so underrepresented, when they are represented, everybody in that community only has a few examples that they can sort of, they can go to. And those examples are not going to suit everybody. So
yeah,
for some people, they might have read it and gone, actually, that's how I feel, and might have taken a positive thing out of it, which says, even though I felt that way, look at what Lupin achieved. Look at what he did. I can, you know, it might have given them hope. Whereas other people might have actually said, no, why do you just assume we're all totally depressed, and that we think of ourselves as lesser, and that we're like this and like that? That's just horrific generalization. And again, it's because there's this huge lack of representation that when you do get small kind of subversive tidbits like that, they're all that a large community have got to go on. So it will cause discourse, I think. And the only way to change that is to just have more examples and to do research and to, you know, try and be sensitive about it.
That is the issue, obviously, where you have an author who's included a character, and they've included, because ultimately one perspective does not represent an entire group of people. It can't,
no,
as you've just said. And obviously, if you've only got the one character, then they, by default, become that group's special possession, almost. And if it doesn't speak for the entire group, that is, as you say, what causes the discord. That's not necessarily entirely the author's fault. I would have said that J.K. Rowling, being an adult all through the 80s and living in Edinburgh, probably gave her quite a broad perspective on the AIDS epidemic. Certainly, growing up through the 80s and experiencing almost firsthand that general fear and the lack of knowledge and everything, I can understand. I wouldn't say that the way people behaved was right, or the way people still behave is right. I understand the fear that comes with it. Because it seemed to come out of nowhere, and it was utterly horrific, and the way it was pushed in our faces was horrific and absolutely terrifying. And as you said, nobody really knew quite how it was transmitted as well, or the fact that, you know, there is a survival rate. There are things being done all the time. And it was awful the way it was pushed on the gay community. It wasn't called HIV. It was called GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency, originally, because people don't understand. Yeah, that's isolating and marginalising. That's a bad thing for everyone.
Yeah.
And it wasn't understood in the same way. I don't think gay people were represented properly. I don't think, I mean, that was the time when you wouldn't openly admit you were gay down in Weymouth, unless you wanted to get your head bashed in, quite literally. So there was a lot of fear, and it all fed into it, and it was this horrible toxic cauldron, ultimately. So I understand that perspective on it. I don't think any of it right.
Well, I think that even as we're talking about this now, there's only one thing we can do, which is we can only speculate. And that's simply because, we can only look, we're looking in from the outside, which means that everything we're saying now, and we both admit to this, it's just speculation of the information that we're receiving.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to be able to recognize that we are not the voices of what is happening there. And it's important to listen to the voices of the people who have experienced it firsthand, who are part of that community, especially when you are talking about it. And that's not to say that we shouldn't write about those things. It's just about recognizing that we are writing about them from the outside looking in.
Which means you'd need to do your due diligence.
Yeah.
I'm not part of... I won't agree with people who say, well, if you're this kind of person, you can only write about your own kind of people kind of thing.
Yeah,
because
no, I don't agree with that.
I think that's very damaging to say that.
It also,
you're creating a them and us by doing that.
You also cause a problem, which is that at the moment, the publishing industry is very... I don't know quite how to say this, but you get the same kind of things, which is that you have main characters who are white and cisgendered and usually heterosexual. And sometimes there are side characters who aren't anymore. And it's also the publishing industry is also governed by people who are white and cisgendered and heterosexual.
And usually male.
And usually male. And whilst sort of that's being pushed through, and again, what I think it's incredibly important to support marginalized authors who are writing about their voice, you know, about characters who are like them, I think it's incredibly important and we should support them. Another way of sort of breaking through and normalizing the, hang on a second, the only people in the world, not all the main characters need to be white, is by also saying that white authors don't have to write white characters. However, again, you need to be careful and you need to be conscious of the fact that you are writing, again, from the outside looking in, and that there are things that you may think you know, but if someone who has actually experienced that says, no, that's wrong, then they probably have more information about it than you do. And it's good to get sort of a wide perspective and to speak to several people and kind of, you know, get a different sort of idea. Because again, one person does not represent an entire community. So it might just be one person says, no, that's wrong. And then another person from the same community goes, no, that's right. That is right. So yeah, talk to a few people and recognize who you are and how you are writing about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously, it's not speculative fiction, but this is something that came up as an issue for Jojo Moyes when she wrote Me Before You.
Yeah.
And obviously he's a quadriplegic, and leaving aside the casting, because, you know, authors really have no control over that whatsoever.
Yeah.
The real issue with it was the fact that a large group of people who were living with those sort of disabilities, or different abilities, if you like, and to be fair, this is a minefield. Some people like to be referred to one way, some prefer the other. Obviously, meaning no offence to anybody here. But, you know, not everybody would feel the same way if they found themselves suddenly paralysed from the neck down. Some people, and I suppose the best example I've got is when I do regular first aid courses, and one of our instructors said once that, you know, if somebody is in a motorbike accident, you need to get the helmet off them, because if you need to perform CPR, then the helmet's going to get in the way, obviously. Now, if they're not moving and they've been in a motorcycle accident, yeah, moving them, you might accidentally break something. But if you don't do anything, they're not breathing. Mm-hmm. So you are making the choice, really, whether to try and help them live or not. And some people, and he said, one person raised the question that, well, you know, what if you do accidentally leave them like paraplegic or quadriplegic? And he said, I've had two cases like that in my life. And he said, one of them said, I wish you'd left. They both said, I wish you'd left me to die. But one of the two cases, he said, he still felt the same way. He wished he'd been left to die. And he did actually go off to Switzerland. The other one said, I'm so grateful to you for saving my life. He said, yeah. I'm living a really rich, full life. Okay, I can't move. And he was paralysed from the neck down. But he said, there's so much in my life that I wasn't paying attention to before. I'm so grateful to still have the chance to be here. So you don't know. You never know, ultimately, is what it came down to. And I think it's the same. You don't, you know, you can't have one character speaking for everybody in this case.
Yeah. And again, I think that this raises the real issue, which is that at this time, people within these communities only do have one or two characters who are meant to be representing them.
Yeah.
And the only way to combat this is to diversify our writing so that the one or two examples they do have aren't just I mean, I on one level I had that problem, which was that when I was trying to sort of come out about my sexuality, for me the easiest kind of way to do that was to sort of talk about characters and say, hey, you know this character? Well, I'm like them.
Yeah.
It was, especially when I was a kid, it was easier if people kind of already were aware of it through fiction and through fiction that they liked. And the problem with me was that the only characters who were bisexual were always depicted in a very sexualized way. So when I'm sort of 15, 16 and trying to say, okay, so you know that character, I'm like them. What I was telling people wasn't I'm bisexual. It's as a 15, 16 year old, I'm a slut. Which, yeah. Again, as an adult, what, however much sex you want to have with whoever, that's like, I don't care, no judgment. But as a 15, 16 year old, having that kind of status in school, I couldn't do that. It would have been social suicide. And, you know, it brought on, when I did use examples like that, it brought on sort of mild cases of sexual assault, which is that because you're like this, you probably enjoy being spanked by strangers or being pinched or touched inappropriately. And that happened to a lot of girls in my school. And again, even if you do have sex in a regular amount, that is not consent for anyone to touch you or to do whatever they want to you, obviously. But again, when you're in school, if that's the only bit you get, that's the only bit you see, and that's the only representation you have, then that's really, really tough. And it's only actually in recent years, and even now not that many, that I've actually found cases of bisexual characters who were like me at the time. And I was bisexual, but also very traditional in the way I was, which is that I did not want to get in bed with anybody who I'd not been in a relationship for with a little while. You know, I was a bit sort of squeamish about kissing and things like that. And there was no one like that to represent me. And that was really tough.
Yeah. And I think there was, and probably still is in some cases, a perception that if you're bisexual, it's more a case of it's definitely a choice. And therefore, you're pretty much up for anything. You're just not picky, or you can't make your mind up. Rather than, no, I just happen to be attracted to both genders if I'm attracted to the person.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, that's what it comes down to, which is we just need more representation. And the moment you have more representation is the moment you can actually start to have more detailed analysis of different lives and viewpoints and voices. But until then, everything is going to fall under scrutiny, except for storylines which are just about white, heterosexual, cisgendered people, because there is so much of that that we don't analyze it in the same way, because our voices are so well represented already as white, cisgendered people.
And that's where fiction itself as a broad body has been subversive without meaning to, by promoting, you know, this normativity of white male, mostly cisgendered heterosexual characters all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the other thing is that because it's done that and that's been so normalized, we start to get other plots which are about, you know, subversive plots, which are entirely inappropriate because they've never been challenged.
Yes.
And it also gets to the point where sometimes in the modern day, you've got plots which were, okay, so for instance, the X-Men, right? That is quite metaphorical. And again, a lot of the imagery they used and a lot of the, you know, the stance they took of the LGBT community.
Yeah.
You know, of the queer community. And during a time where the queer community was kind of pushing back and coming out more, and it was, yeah, a lot of the discourse and the way that they discuss it and things like that, that's what it was about. And they couldn't have a popular comic during the time when it was first coming out, which was about the queer community, but they were sending out a message about the queer community at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Now, however, it's no longer really relevant in that sense, which is that it was really forward thinking at the time when it was coming out, because they were limited by what they could produce without being in danger, I think, and without being, you know, without completely ruining themselves.
Yeah.
But now you can't justify it in the same way, which is that it's no longer a metaphor for it, because that is not the life. I mean, it is still in some places, but it's not what we're seeing in the Western world, what we're facing in the Western world. It's no longer progressive in the same way. What would be progressive is to now actually include LGBT characters, which they have slowly, but it's it's still quite slow. But that's an example of something which started off as a metaphor and is no longer really viable in the same way as a metaphor.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, okay, since we're talking about sexuality at the moment, I've just read an advanced reader copy of Red Sister by Mark Lawrence, which has all the action, blood and gore that you would expect from Mark Lawrence. It's extremely good. But what really struck me about that book, on one hand, it's almost entirely female characters. Almost entirely. There are one or two male characters in that book that actually have speaking parts.
Yeah.
And I didn't notice that until halfway through the book, which sounds insane, but they're just so well written, you don't notice it. It doesn't matter. It's not a big bearing on the plot, as it were. And it's set in a convent where you have these basically battle mage nuns teaching girls, that teaching the future generation of novices, which is really good. And how he represents a convent school like that, a convent girls' school, is uncanny, even up to and including the point where when the girls are, you know, hitting puberty and starting to be interested in things like sex and relationships and, you know, finding out about themselves, it's not uncommon for a couple of girls to hop into bed together.
Yeah.
And it's not a case of this is your sexuality forevermore. This is just a case of, okay, well, we're all together and, you know what, by day we fight and we try and poison each other, but, you know, by night we've got really, really close bonds of friendship that sometimes develop into something else. And I think sometimes it is, you know, it's been said a lot of times that it's perfectly normal to have crushes on people of the same gender as you when you're growing up.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily define you. And I think perhaps making less of the whole sort of people being definitely one sexuality or another or somewhere in the middle or no sexuality at all.
Yeah.
Was actually probably quite a positive representation.
Yeah.
And in fairness, as someone who went to a convent school, I can absolutely assure you that was all going on. So that was absolutely accurate. I don't know who he spoke to, but it was almost word for word in some cases.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's going on either just because there's a dearth of male company. I think it's going on and happening more in a sort of single sex education environment like that because nobody bats an eyelid at it, really.
Yeah. And there's less kind of judgment in some ways. I think perhaps that's more the case with all girls than all boys.
Quite probably. Obviously, I've not been a boy in a boys' school, so I can't comment on that.
But yeah. Whereas, obviously, there actually is a history of, you know, all boys' schools where it was happening because it was just they weren't allowed to see girls, you know, and they were. And so it was almost kind of encouraged. Just get it out of your system. And that's just a boyish thing to do. But when you're older, you're men and that's that. And so even straight men were and straight boys were doing it just because it was the done thing. And I don't know whether that's still the case in boys school. We'd have to ask someone who went to an all boys school.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, I would say it's not all girls, but a good 80% of them. At a conservative estimate, a good 80% of them were at some point.
I cannot comment. I never went to either an all-boys school or an all-girls school, so can't comment there. But
I just find it refreshing to see it represented in a way that isn't divisive, I suppose.
Yeah. So, so what's that book called?
Red Sister.
Red Sister. Okay. All right. Interesting. Might check that out.
It's very good just in general, actually. But, anyway, getting back to subversive plots. It might be good to do a bit of a callback to our first ever episode.
Yes, our first ever episode, when we were talking about fairy tales, and I talked about Cinderella and how it was possibly unintentional, but it was about class.
Yeah.
In that you had Cinderella, who was a servant, and worse than a servant, she was basically a slave. And she rose up to become the prince's, not his concubine, but his wife, his bride, the future queen.
Yeah, acknowledged as an equal as that time would allow.
And acknowledged as an equal, even at the moment where she appeared before him as a servant. And that, again, it emphasised this idea, which is that she didn't appear before him in a beautiful gown as she had, you know, it wasn't trickery at that moment. She appeared before him as she was, which was dirty and dressed in rags. And she said, I am, you know, and he put on the shoe and he recognised who she was. He didn't, there was no trickery about it.
No.
And they fell, he was still in love with her, despite her status, which is again something that during the time, there was this, I'm of a high class, you're of a low class kind of thing. Now, some people could argue, well, technically she was high class, she was just pushed down. But she wasn't high class enough that anyone noticed when she was pushed down.
No, she no one. It was lower aristocracy, and they had a lot of lower aristocracy and gentry.
Yeah. She wasn't high class enough that anyone realised that she was missing, to be honest. That anyone knew who she was. They didn't know who she was. So she was a low enough class to have been considered lesser, to have not been considered at all.
And it is something to think about, because the divide was so great for so many years based on the feudal system. The mm-hmm. idea was that if you were actually part of the working and lower class, the people who were descended from the serfs and the churls, what that comes down to is their lives were actually considered of far less value than, say, a good horse.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, almost a different species.
Yeah. And so to have this plot, which was actually the total contrary, which was that you are not lesser, and you can be loved for who you are, at that time was actually pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, I think that it became popular during this, in America especially, during a time, which is that there's the American dream, the American thing, which is that no matter where you come from, you can make something of yourself.
Yeah.
And so it became popular around the time of the new opportunity. And it doesn't surprise me that they said this is a story we'll put out there and that people will like it.
No, it would fit in with that.
Yeah, and in the same way, Beauty and the Beast has a kind of a similar sort of thing, which is that she was not, she was just a bit of a peasant girl, and she was just from a small little village. And in the original, you know, she had, well, in the original, it was a different story, but in the one that, you know, the Grimms, it was the Grimms? Was it the Brothers Grimm?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, she had sisters and stuff like that as well. And then, you know, their father was a merchant, but he wasn't, you know, that he was still a class below. And yet she ends up in this huge castle in the end with a member of the aristocracy. And it was this, that she earned that through kindness and love. And he fell in love with her. Not because he had to, but they genuinely fell in love with each other.
Yeah. And I think there was an element of the fact that she was doing her duty and working hard as well. And
yeah,
the message that would send out potentially, because it was kind of a repeated oral folk tale as well.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why that raised a few eyebrows amongst the aristocracy, because that's saying to this entire underclass of people that you've probably not treated very well, that, you know what, they have the right to take your place. And then, of course, France did go and have several revolutions which were pretty much about that, so
yeah,
maybe they were right to worry.
There is something else, however, which is a problem in a lot of fiction, and I think I'm possibly guilty of it as well. A problem of elitism. Now not so much in class, that there is an element of the class as well, a big element of class actually, but in intelligence.
Yeah.
And I think Forrest Gump is an excellent piece of fiction which addresses something, which is that at the moment we put a lot and a lot of emphasis on intelligence. And that's coming back with, you know, the Sherlock Holmes and a lot of the TV shows at the moment where the main characters are smart.
Yeah.
And Belle was above all of the others in the village because she was bookish and she was smart. And it's not that none of the others weren't working hard. You know, this was a working village. They were all working hard. But what made her special, what made her better than all of them, was that she loved books.
Yeah, well, certainly in the Disney version, in the original fairy tale, she's only above them because she's beautiful and kind.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, and yeah, that's what I mean is that now at the moment we're looking at this new kind of this prejudice, which is that clever people are better, which kind of needs to be combated a little, which is that intelligence shouldn't be everything, especially academic intelligence, and telling readers that they're better than people who don't read, I think is a big problem, because there's this kind of classism now that comes with reading, which actually kind of puts other people off reading, I think.
I'm not sure about that bit, to be quite honest.
Well, no, I mean, it was something that, as you know, because I couldn't read when I was growing up.
What I mean is I've got no frame of reference for this at all, so I'm not disagreeing. Yeah. I don't know enough to be able to agree or disagree.
Well, do you agree that books are not, shouldn't be elitist?
No, they absolutely shouldn't. And what you read shouldn't be elitist. You shouldn't be considered stupid because you like Mills and Boone. I mean, I think you're probably a little bit nuts, but good for you. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's this kind of perception, because you have the bookworm character. And then what happens very often is you have the bookworm character and then everyone else is just, they're like, what? Books? No, I can't even read. And that's how you identify that they're dumb. And that's how you identify that they're less worthy, you know? And you see a lot of that in a lot of modern kind of fiction, which is that just because I like to read and the bullies don't like to read, the bullies think books are dumb. And actually, more often than not, the bullies that I met in real life would also read books. They could read. In fact, it was very uncommon that they couldn't read. And this emphasis that not reading makes people stupid, or that if you do read, you are a nerd, or that there's this separation, which means that actually some people go, well, if I get seen with a book, if I get seen with this book, people will think this of me, or people will think that of me, regardless of the book. If I, adults reading young adult fiction, or adults browsing adult fiction, if I I got spotted in the children's section, because I like reading children's books every now and again for a number of reasons, market research among them, but also because I like children's fiction. And someone immediately said, are you buying for your child? And I was just like, first of all, do I look old enough to have a child who's between 8 and 12? Don't answer that. Second of all, why do we have to say that no, only these kinds of people should be reading these books? And if you're not that kind of person, we shouldn't make assumptions about that. And we shouldn't also put importance on people who do read. Just because you're a book nerd, just because you manage to read 12 million books a day does not make you better than someone who only managed to read once a month. And it does not make you it doesn't necessarily mean that you love books more. Someone can love books but still take a long time to read them.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I would expand it and say, actually, people who willfully cling to a narrow frame of experience are perhaps setting themselves up to be challenged.
Yeah, no,
in that respect.
And I agree with that. It's just that at the moment, we are putting this emphasis on academic intelligence, which is perhaps a little bit damaging.
Yeah, I mean, academic intelligence is really only useful in academic circles.
Yeah.
Unless you know how to think instead of what to think, then it's not really that valuable, except in certain areas. And very little of life is just based on scientific and mathematical fact. It's always good to have those as a backup, and I'm certainly not propounding that we all start talking about alternative facts, for example, but and I do still think that reading is probably one of the best ways to get a big broad groundwork. If you can't afford to, say, fly all over the world or live in lots of different countries, it's a good way, but you shouldn't limit yourself to one narrow band of things, then say, yeah, well, I know as much as anybody else, and anything outside of the bits I like to read is stupid. I do occasionally get looked down on by people who read more literary fiction, which I do read occasionally, but I won't just read literary fiction because it's turned up on the Man Booker Prize list, because a lot of that I find quite, it's work as well, and since yeah. I'm quite happy to read hard books with long words and whatever, that's not a problem for me, but my time is limited, so I like to read what I like as well. Yeah. I want it to be an enjoyable experience as much as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also quite sophistical to say that only reading a narrow category of books would limit you, because if you take Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who wrote Purple Hibiscus and Half of Yellow Sun, and is a Man Booker Prize winning author who speaks very fluently on feminism and feminism with POC, she grew up reading Mills and Boone exclusively. So, you know, it's damaging to make assumptions. I'd agree with that. And I think there is a certain amount of snobbery in certain circles. I've noticed it among certain book bloggers.
Yeah.
Who are sort of like, well, I read this, I read the classics. And it's like, well, that's great. I like to read those too. I also quite like to read the Greek philosophers at times. I like to read what I'm in the mood for, ultimately.
Yeah.
It doesn't set you in a you're not in a class above by yourself kind of thing. No.
And again, I think it's important to recognise and to have... One of the reasons actually I really like the Percy Jackson series was that, first of all, they were dyslexic, or it wasn't that they were dyslexic in the end, but they Percy Jackson as a main character really struggled in school, which I think is something that a lot of people associate with. They really, really struggled in school, but they were good at other things. And that they didn't, that they were smart in different ways. And there's lots of different ways of being smart. And being academically smart is one of them, but that is just a specialized, they're all specialized. There are some people who are incredibly charismatic. There are some people who are incredibly witty without actually necessarily being well-read. There are some people who are good with their hands. There are some people who are good on their feet. You know, there's lots of different kinds of intelligence, and there's lots of different ways of excelling. And I think at the moment we are putting and glorifying too much the emphasis of intelligence only academically, and that we often have intelligent people who are intelligent in lots and lots and lots and lots of different ways, which can be a little bit limiting if you only have characters who are like that, and it's good to sort of play around with it a little bit. And it's also, I think it's possibly time that we sort of started to remove certain stereotypes that we usually attribute to villains. And one stereotype is beauty and vanity, or saying, actually, one of my biggest selling points, one thing that I'm really good at, is my physical appearance. I think it's okay to do that. It's okay to be a person who says, actually, one thing I really value is how I look and how people perceive me, because that can be important to some people. And it's, and I think we should allow that to be important to some people.
I don't think that necessarily, certainly what has been played out is the whole, oh, I'm so plain, but secretly I'm gorgeous kind of thing. I just don't know I am.
Yeah. I think it's okay to have a character who says, I've dressed up nicely and I feel nice. Because I think the most beautiful person on earth is probably aware of the fact that they're beautiful, because they've probably put some effort into it. And they probably have moments where they go, I don't feel particularly beautiful today. And then they have moments where they've spent like an hour getting everything together and they're like, I feel epic.
Well, I mean, I have Grace in her novella going that, you know, she's having her bit at the beginning where she's avoiding mirrors. And she actually says, I'd never had a problem with mirrors before. I know I'm beautiful, I don't need to check every 5 minutes kind of thing, which would sound incredibly big-headed to most people, but it's just, she's just stating a fact, you know?
Yeah,
And it's not like she's really arrogant about it. It's just kind of like, no, I know I'm good looking. I'm also more than that, but you know.
I think probably one of the most damaging things, especially for young girls that we're seeing a lot of in fiction, is this kind of subversion, which is that you need to be modest. And the thing is, false modesty does not work.
No.
And it kind of... I think looks is a good example of it. But, you know, when I accept a compliment, sometimes people look shocked, especially if I accept it on just straight away. People say, you look nice today. And I say, thank you, rather than, oh, you know, no, or I blush, or, you know, kind of I look away. And sometimes that is my natural reaction. If people compliment me and I'm not expecting it, then I will kind of actually tend to be a little bit taken aback. But if I put an effort into something and someone says, that's good, I'll say thank you. And I'll acknowledge it because I also think it's good, especially if it's something I've worked on. I wouldn't release it to the world unless I thought it was good. And I think we should be allowed to think positive, happy things about ourselves. There's a difference between acknowledging something and being proud of something and... you know, being aware of the quality of something without being big-headed. I think big-headedness or sort of it gets too much when you think you are the best and you are alone the best and that no one else is, and that you deserve more time than anyone else and that you deserve more attention than anyone else. That's when it becomes a problem. But I think to just say, actually, I do deserve attention, and I deserve the attention that I'm getting, should not be shown in a negative way. And I think very often it is done in a very, very subversive way, in that we're shown these characters of who you should be if you want to be the heroine. And who you should be if you want to be the heroine is that you are gorgeous, but you shouldn't be aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely okay to take up the space you need, ultimately.
Yeah.
In real life. And it should be okay to show characters who think, no, I have value and I can take up the space. That's not to say they won't ever have an insecure moment, because it would be perfectly natural to, unless you're incredibly confident.
Yeah. People can be insecure, but they can also be confident.
Very few people are insecure about everything. And if they were, they wouldn't be very interesting people to read, because you'd just constantly be reading a litany of things they're insecure about. You as the reader would feel like somebody who had to reassure the main character, which is not, that's not a fun experience for anyone.
No. So I think we're actually running out of time, Jules.
We are coming towards the end. Just a slight sidestep on subversive fiction, or subversive messages in fiction. There are authors who quite possibly set out to write something that was deliberately subversive. And as an example, and obviously this has consequences, obviously the Salman Rushdie, who wrote the Satanic Verses. And if you don't know what the Satanic Verses is, it's about the life of Muhammad. And the Satanic Verses themselves are verses in the Quran whereby you are actually allowed to address three pagan deities. Now, this put quite a lot of noses out of joint, and Rushdie was put under fatwa by the Ayatollah, which is a death sentence for those who don't know it.
Okay.
Which is why he's currently living in hiding. So, yeah, be aware that what you put out there might well have consequences. But that should include things that aren't deliberately offensive as well. I mean, maybe you see the world in one way and somebody else sees it in another. One that comes to mind is, I spoke recently about Carve the Mark by Veronica Roth, and leaving the POC side of it to one side for the time being, a lot of people were up in arms about her betrayal of chronic pain. And while I read it and thought, that doesn't represent my experience, but for her, maybe that absolutely does represent her experience.
Yeah.
And we're back once again to the problem whereby an example is a problem because it's an example.
Yeah. And that the only way to figure all of that out is to just have more representation.
Yeah. Which not everybody can do. I mean, the fact that she actually bothered to represent something like that is quite important, I think.
Yeah.
Although I think perhaps she could have done it a bit more sensitively in some areas, because maybe her personal belief system allows her to say, well, you know what, being a chronic pain sufferer means that I'm strong. I'm made strong because I can live with it.
Yeah.
That's kind of a bit of an up yours to everybody else who isn't, or it's an up yours to the chronic pain sufferers who do find that they can't get out of bed certain days.
Yeah.
So... You can be a bit more sensitive about how you do these things.
Yeah.
So that was, oof, gosh.
That was a bit heftier than we were expecting.
That was heavy, but I'm glad we spoke about it.
Yes.
So well, if you guys have any comments or books or things like that that you'd like to share with us, where you feel the subversive plot has worked or hasn't worked, or you disagree with anything that we've said, please do get in touch with us and let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes.
And on that note, we'll say
On
goodbye.
that note, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.